Hi, this is Doc Radio.
Broadcasting to the world. Broadcasting to the world.
BlakeRadio.com. Music for your mind, body, and soul. Talk radio at its best. You're listening to Rainbow Soul from BlakeRadio.com.
This is Dr. Jennifer Daniels, and you are listening to Healing with Dr. Daniels on the Rainbow Soul channel at BlakeRadio.com. Please forgive the delay in the start of today's show. I'm telling you, this is the third internet connection I've attempted, but I am here. As always, please visit Amazon.com. Murder by Medicine is no accident, and be the first in your circle to get Dr. Daniels' new Kindle book, Murder by Medicine is no accident. Get your personal edition. You no longer have to fumble and stutter as you try to tell your loved ones of the medical dangers. It even gave my editor goosebumps. A great read. Amazon.com. And, of course, I welcome your calls and questions, so please call in at 914-338-0695. All right, today's topic is the greatest good for the greatest number is no good for you. Now, today's topic may sound trivial, but it is another very important nail in the coffins of 851,000 Americans in 2011. Why can't I mention 2012? Because they stopped keeping statistics in 2012. So the concept of the greatest good for the greatest number is essential to seducing many kind-hearted but obedient doctors into committing the acts of harm that culminated in the deaths of these 851,000 Americans in the year 2011. Now, the greatest good for the greatest number sounds good, but let's dig a little deeper. The shocking application of this concept is not apparent until we look into the meaning of each part of this phrase. For example, have you ever wondered what the word good means in the context of medicine? And good for whom? And how do we decide whose good gets counted? What about the greatest? If there's the greatest, it must be greater than something. What is it greater than? And how is the greatest defined? And who's included in this definition? Who counts the greatest? How often is the count done? And how does the doctor know when there's been a recount? What about the greatest number? Number of what? And what is the greatest number compared to what? This may sound confusing, so let's dive in. We're going to answer these questions, and the answers will paint an incredible picture. As always, you're listening to Healing with Dr. Daniels on the Rainbow Soul channel at BlakeRadio.com. Please visit Amazon.com and get Murder by Medicine is No Accident. Be the first in your circle to get Dr. Daniels' new Kindle book, Murder by Medicine is No Accident. As I said, it even gave my editor goosebumps. A great read. And we're at Amazon.com. And I welcome your calls and questions, so please call in at 914-338-0695. All right, so let's tackle the first question. What is good? What does it mean, good? Well, you'll be shocked to know that good is defined as receiving a diagnosis. And good is defined as receiving proper therapy. Also, good is defined as a statistical improvement in survival. It can also mean conserving the finances or increasing the revenue of an institution. namely an insurance company or a hospital or a drug company. The patient is presumed to be insured, so conserving the finances of the patient is never an issue. Now notice what's not defined as good. Improving a patient's welfare or well-being is not considered good or part of the good. And good for whom? Well, the medical profession, of course, the career of the doctor, or the 313 million Americans who are not in the exam room. I have a different field I'm working with today. So, how are the greatest good counted? Well, they're counted in studies done by scientists who are paid, for the most part, by hospitals, insurance companies, or drug companies. And these studies have been found to have an 85% rate of having results that are not able to be verified when the study is repeated by qualified researchers. The good, as determined by these studies, are then extrapolated to large numbers of people. Cholesterol studies, for example, determined that 1 in 250 people who take statin drugs for 5 years will benefit. In other words, one person benefits after 1,250 person years of use. Since no one person can take anything for 1,250 years, then of course it's not possible for any one person to benefit. But because the benefit is extrapolated over large numbers, theoretically, several people could benefit when thousands of people use these drugs. You're listening to Healing with Dr. Daniels on the Rainbow Soul channel at blakeradio.com. Please visit amazon.com. Murder by Medicine is no accident. And be the first in your circle to get Dr. Daniels' new Kindle book, Murder by Medicine is No Accident. You no longer have to fumble and stutter as you try to tell your loved ones of the medical dangers. It even gave my editor goosebumps. A great read. I welcome your calls, of course, and questions. Please call in at 914-338-0695. Okay, so who are counted in the greatest number? This is important because it's the greatest number, right? That means you can't possibly count everyone, so you've got to be selective. You only can only count the greatest number. Well, it turns out, when we're talking about who's going to benefit, only groups are counted. This mythical greatest number includes all the members of an HMO, for example, or the shareholders of a hospital, or the collective group of taxpayers, members of a group that are screened for a disease. It's not possible for the good of any individual, specifically one patient, to outweigh the good of such groups, because the patient only gets one vote. Therefore, the greatest good for the greatest number never includes the good experienced by the patient sitting in front of the doctor in the present moment. Put more precisely, if the act that might benefit the individual in front of the doctor but would not benefit the greatest good, the patient always loses. If the contemplated test, such as a mammogram, would result in one life saved, per 125,000 mammograms, then screening 1 million women would extend the life of 8 women by theoretically 5 years, while subjecting 5,000 women to unnecessary chemotherapy, surgery, and radiation, and leading to the premature death of at least 250 women. Now, the benefit to the 8 outweighs the 0 benefit to the woman sitting in the office, and possible harm is never counted. Why? Because we're talking about the greatest good for the greatest number. Only the greatest good and the greatest number are considered. So such conflicts can never be resolved in favor of the patient that is under direct consideration, because only good is being considered, not harm. And collective good, of which the patient is only one, is being counted. This means that the patient only counts as one when calculating good. Therefore, his good can never outweigh the good of a group, even a group whose number is, say, 2 or 3. if this is greater, the next thing you have to look at is greater than what? The answer? Greater than the good of the one patient under consideration. Sad but true. You're listening to Healing with Dr. Daniels on the Rainbow Soul channel at BlakeRadio.com. Please visit Amazon.com and get your copy of Murder by Medicine is No Accident. Be the first in your circle to review Dr. Daniels' new Kindle book, Murder by Medicine is No Accident, and get your personal Kindle edition. As I said, you no longer have to fumble and stutter as you try to tell your loved ones of the medical dangers. It even gave my editor goosebumps. A great read. I welcome your calls and questions. Please call in at 914-338-0695. Now, to talk about the greatest good, it's kind of a presumption that's the greatest good for society. Well, the question is, what is society and who is a member of this society that we're going to be benefiting here? Well, society is the status quo. Now, for many reasons, the status quo may not benefit any one particular patient at any one particular point in time. Of course, it can't possibly, right? Because the patient is sick, he's trying to get better, so he's seeking to change the status quo. So what benefits society is likely at that point in time to not benefit that particular patient. So what is society? Society is a structure that makes the delivery of health care and the payment of for it possible. This is actually very clearly defined in medical school. You know, we function within the structure of a society, and it's that society that supports us. And so we have to support society because it supports us as physicians and our superior position. Okay, so what is society? It's any and every institution that supports medicine. The judges that compel submission to therapy. The police that snatch babies from the arms of their mothers for vaccination and incarcerate parents for noncompliance. The educational system, K-12, that makes it possible to qualify for college, that makes it possible to qualify for medical school. The medical school itself, industry that employs people and deducts money from their pay every month for health insurance so they cannot foolishly spend it on frivolous pleasures. And it will be available to enrich the pockets of doctors when the time comes. And, of course, all doctors are members of society. I had a little issue with this when I was in medical school. As an African-American, a member of a minority group, and one who had a lifetime, again, no, I might say a lifetime, but many years prior to the Civil Rights Movement, where definitely the interests of society didn't seem to coincide with mine, I felt a little like, well, you know what? There's a lot of good people out there who maybe at the point when they're seeing the doctor, their interests and society's interests may not coincide. So who's not counted? Well, people who are not counted are people who don't benefit society. I found this pretty shocking, too, when I was in medical school, that someone who does not benefit society doesn't count. They're not the ones that we're trying to benefit. So you're listening to Healing with Dr. Daniels on the Rainbow Soul channel at BlakeRadio.com. Please visit Amazon.com and be the first in your group to review Murder by Medicine is No Accident. This is my first book based on this radio series. So check it out. I think you'll like it a whole lot. Get your personal Kindle edition. And you no longer have to fumble and stutter as you try to tell your loved ones of the medical dangers. You can just say, hey, read Dr. Daniels' book. And as always, I welcome your calls and questions. Please call in at 914-338-0695. So who is it that doesn't benefit society? Now, there is a little puzzle. You'll be shocked to know that there's a long list of these people who don't benefit society. These are people whoever does not conform to, participate in, or obey the rules of society as described above. So let me give you the list. So non-vaccinators are not a benefit to society, right? Irresponsible people. Homeschoolers, they're not submitting to the K-12 routine. People on welfare, they're not paying taxes, they're not paying health insurance premiums. They're not increasing the size of the pool that doctors and the healthcare system can draw from. Incarcerated people, people who have not completed 23 years of education, people who are not employed, people who are non-compliant with medical therapy, who are disobedient to the doctor. These are people who don't benefit society, as defined in medical school. People who are divorced. People who have been convicted of a crime of any sort. Heck with this saying, your debt to society, the debt is eternal. People who used to be incarcerated. People who have been accused of a crime. People who disagree with a rule that society has established. People who do not take responsibility and make sure that their spouse, children, relatives comply with medical therapy. People who are trying to take advantage of any pool of money established for the benefit of a group, even if they are a member of that group, unless the payment goes to the individual doctor. Such a pool of money may be sick leave, disability payments, activation of insurance claims, or benefits. So why aren't these people counted? Because this always puzzled me. And even though I am African American, I was not raised in the church, so I didn't have this strong sense of good and evil. I had this sense that everyone could be good and everyone could be encouraged to be good. And so when we had this sorting of people into members of society, sort of sorting of society, deserving, not deserving, good, the greatest good, I was really very confused. So why aren't these people counted? Well, they're not counted because they're not contributing to the good of the whole. The greatest good cannot possibly be served by focusing on individually benefiting these individuals. So who's doing the counting? There's a good question. This was never clarified to my satisfaction. You can imagine, in medical school, they were like real thrilled when I raised my hand to ask, who's counting? How will I know that what I'm doing is contributing to the greatest good? If I don't even know who's counting, I can't, you know, where do I go to get the count? So somehow, researchers are believed to be doing this counting in some impartial and very scientific way. And researchers always consider the benefits and risks of therapies, so no further consideration on the part of the doctor was necessary. And so that the harm done by side effects was always less than the good done by the treatment. It was implied that there was some counting going on and more people in some group somewhere were getting benefit than were being harmed or inconvenienced. However, when one reads the studies closely, and I've read a few of these scientific studies, it is clear that the harm has to result in nothing short of death in order to be considered too great to justify therapy. Of course, on the other hand, we're told in medical school, if someone dies during a research study, like they have to be removed from the study, they can't be counted. Why? Well, because you can't take a blood pressure on a dead patient. So obviously you can't count that patient as a member of the study. So this is very confusing. So in other words, if someone survived the therapy and didn't die, then any negative effects were minimized or dismissed. And if they did die, they were dismissed from the study. So it's tough to measure negative effects. So, of course, the greatest good for the greatest number literally meant that only good was being counted. So, however, when one reads the studies closely, it's clear the harm has to result in nothing short of death, as I said, in order to be considered too great to justify therapy. On another level, who should decide who gets care and who should not? Well, the only clear location of authority on this is that the doctor had the authority only to recommend, and the hospital and insurance companies have the authority to deny, but the patient does not have the authority to decline. So the patient does not have the authority to request something that has not been offered. It does not have the right to deny something that has been offered. So the locus of control is that the doctor always recommends, and then it's the hospital and the insurance companies as institutions that have the authority to deny care of any kind. So you're listening to Healing with Dr. Daniels on the Rainbow Soul channel at blakeradio.com. Please visit amazon.com and be the first in your group to review Murder by Medicine is No Accident. Be the first in your circle to get Dr. Daniels' new Kindle book. You no longer have to fumble and stutter as you try to tell your loved ones of the medical dangers. It even gave my editor goosebumps. A great read, amazon.com, Murder by Medicine is No Accident. As always, I welcome your calls and questions, so please call in at 914-338-0695. Now, While the patient may decline, he's not a good person if he does. If he does decline therapy, he is labeled as noncompliant, and any evil that may befall him in his life is attributed to his refusal to comply with doctor's orders. It was generally accepted that the insurance companies were the final judge of the greatest good, as they had the greatest number of patients aggregated in one spot. The government could decide as they were elected democratically by the citizens. More recently, the government has clear authority as rulers of the Medicare, Medicaid, and now Obamacare program. Any individual patient could not decide to consume or not to consume medical care because they lacked the perspective of the greatest number, perspective of the many. They also lacked the necessary judgment and impartiality. Because the patient's life and health were at stake, they could not be trusted to make a decision that would result in the greatest good for the greatest number. So when is the count updated? Guess what? No clue. No clue. So while passing mention is made in medical school to how many people had to be treated in order for one person to benefit, or how many years a person had to take medication in order to benefit, this is immediately followed by a pronouncement that the value of the therapy to increasing the greatest good is worth it. At no point is a doctor given a denominator, so the curious or inclined might be able to make a calculation or exert independent judgment. The doctor is never given a calculation of the harm done by the therapy in hard, cold numbers, or a calculation of the numbers of people who benefit, or what the benefit is. For example, what good is a heart attack prevention program that only prevents deadly heart attacks, when only 1 in 20 heart attacks results in death? What about the suffering and debilitation of the non-fatal heart attacks? That doesn't get prevented? Yet, such therapies are in use even now. This is left vague. In fact, I will bet you that most doctors do not even know that only 1 in 20 heart attacks are deadly. They didn't teach me that in medical school. I had to go dig for that myself. Now, it's not taught in medical school. The other figure, 30% of Americans die of cardiovascular disease, most of which, by the way, are not heart attacks, is instead used to intimidate doctors into passing the intimidation on to patients to get them to submit to therapy that creates the greatest good for the greatest number. So this guarantees the greatest good for the greatest number will never be of good for the one patient that stands before the doctor at any one moment. For example, prostate cancer. Prostate cancer is treated by chemotherapy, radioactive pellets implanted in the poor guy's prostate, and surgery. Never mind, it is a positive marker for longevity. It has been classified as a disease to be cured. The cure for longevity, that be murder, sounds illegal to me, but doctors are trained to deliver it. Only 1 month ago, the Journal of the American Medical Association finally confessed that prostate cancer, also known as high-grade prostatic intraepithelial neoplasia, should no longer be called cancer. Instead, the condition should be labeled something more appropriate, like indolent lesions of epithelial origin. Idle. English interpretation, inactive, harmless. However, they're still debating at what point the public should be informed of this. Still, doctors are treating this condition with deadly force. The greatest good for the greatest number prevails. This means that those who have the authority and wisdom have made the rules and protocols. Individual knowledge of a method that may be more humane or even safer for an individual patient cannot be applied, as the doctor has to wait until the greater good for the greatest number has determined that it is okay, and how it is okay to factor this information into the day-to-day care of patients. This means that doctor is armed with vague pronouncements, no details. This means he cannot make a case-by-case determination or even give an individual adjustment. This means a doctor cannot give any one patient useful information that would result in a conclusion about the greatest good for any individual patient. You're listening to Healing with Dr. Daniels on the Rainbow Soul channel at BlakeRadio.com. We have a question here. Let me see if I can figure out how to do this. Hello, 3744, you're on the air.
Hi, it's Theron Burrow in Brooklyn. How are you today?
Pretty good. Great to hear from you.
Okay. I just wanted to share that when I was listening to the story of that Dr. Wakefield who says that autism is caused by mercury in the vaccines, he said, as though it were perfectly normal, I mean, he did a great thing by exposing that. He said he was, you know, a bad person. But he said, well, you know, the way vaccines works is that it averages out that, you know, although some may be harmed by it, that on average most will not be, and the result will be that we eradicate the disease.
Exactly.
So that is an example of where this extremely conscientious and kindly man bought this thing, hook, line, and sinker. And if you would elaborate maybe on how doctors believe these things or, like, how this has sprung on them, that would be very interesting. Because, you know, my mother's family were, you know, farming people who generations ago became lawyers and professors. And these people like John Dewey and B.F. Skinner, just they were sent in by these lunatics who are running this operation. And over a period of time, they just talk and they say, well, this is the way it is. And then the upper classes or the people that become the credible classes, the intellectuals, believe them. And then nobody questions those people who went to college. And
exactly.
You can see that it's amazing how they do this. And it's so refreshing to hear you, having been inside, describe the thing with such clarity. So I wanted to contribute that, and I'll go back to listening now.
Okay, great. Thank you.
Thank you.
Get the right button here. Okay, well, that's interesting perspective. How is it that doctors are drummed into believing this? Doctors are told that it is their obligation to provide the greatest good for the greatest number. In other words, in the case of women with breast cancer, if you need to get a full 1 million women getting these mammograms in order to get 8 women to benefit. And if you leave a mammogram undone, you might have failed to mammogram the one of those 8 ladies who would have benefited. And that lack of benefit is then your responsibility, your fault, and on your conscience. And so this is accomplished by drilling into doctors only the greatest good for the greatest number. Notice at no point in medical school was I told of these 1 million that 5,000 women would get unnecessary mastectomies. That number just is not revealed. So it is only the greatest good, only for the greatest number that is considered. And so when you mention something like either a woman dying as a result of her chemotherapy or radiation or a surgical complication from mammogram that, you know, for a cancer she didn't have, that's considered in isolation. It's never added up collectively to reach, say, the 5,000 who suffer this fate of being unnecessarily mutilated. So you always measure any harm as one side effect occurring in isolation to one person. But the good is always collective. So there's 1 million ladies. There's 8 ladies in this 1 million that are going to benefit. And by golly, as a doctor, it is your job to be absolutely thorough and steadfast. Insist every lady get a mammogram so those 8 women are detected and that they experience the benefit. And that is the mentality, even with the immunizations. In medical school, there was never any mention of harm from immunizations, only the good. And the good is that X number of children will benefit. Mysteriously, X number of children will benefit. But the only side effect, honestly, in medical school is mentioned in terms of vaccines was irritability and fever. As far as a seizure, the only way you're going to know about that is if you actually give a vaccine to a kid and you actually witness a seizure right there on the spot. But it was never revealed. And because of the way medical school is taught, the doctor is inundated with false and irrelevant information. And at such a fast rate that he is sleep-deprived, and just separating it out is an overwhelming task. Even the effort to try and separate out will result in a decline in your grades so swift that you wouldn't be able to graduate. And so the system is designed that the doctor doesn't have the time to sift. I mean, even the calculations I've done necessary for this radio show. In medical school, I just didn't, one, I didn't have the time, and two, without the internet, there was simply no access to that data. Because before the first semester of medical school, I'm telling you, I was going to the library on my own, look up a few things. I mean, I had some questions, but the books weren't there. The references weren't there. And so this is pre-internet and even pre-computerized search. Everything is manual search. So I didn't have the time or the resources, the accessibility, the structure wasn't there to access data to answer the many, many questions that I had. I even took to reading package inserts. When I would do a rotation, I would snatch a package insert and stuff it in my pocket. Whenever I had a spare moment, I would sit down on the floor and peel open the package insert and read it. These things back then were an inch and a half wide and 3 feet long, written in 7-point type. And senior doctors would see me reading these package inserts and say, "What are you doing?" As if I was committing a crime. So doctors are given limited information in medical school. They're given very biased information in medical school, and they're discouraged from asking questions. And any exhibition of curiosity or interest is ridicule. So that's pretty much how that happens. And then by the time you graduate from medical school, you think it's your idea. You don't say, "Hey, wait a minute, I was sleep deprived, I was bamboozled, I pulled the wool over my eyes, let me go see what I can figure out on my own. Now that I got some sleep, under my belt, let me go see what I can sort out." So that never happens. And then in medical school, we're told there are only certain credible sources of information. You cannot give equal credibility to something you read in a medical journal and something you hear on the radio or something you a patient brings in online, brings to you from the internet or any other source. And you certainly cannot believe your own observation. That's the last thing you believe is your own observation, because you are only observing one patient out of millions, and these scientists have gone and looked at the millions. They've done the count, a count you can rely on. And so do not, under any circumstances, rely on your direct observation. And when you tell someone that, you can get them into this greatest good for greatest number type thinking and really get them doing a tremendous amount of harm with the greatest of intention. And that's the best of it, because the doctor really believes he is doing good. So he doesn't even need to deceive the patient. And so if you have a patient going in there trying to detect if the doctor's lying to him, that patient will get snookered every time. Why? Because the doctor believes what he's saying. So instead of relying on his own observation, which, you know, you would think a prudent person might, the doctor relies on a set of protocols called the standard of care. These dangerous practices kill 851,000 Americans each year and are, make no mistake about it, the number one cause of death in America. Clearly, the greatest good would result if doctors would cease and desist. But there is no protocol for this. And while it may be the greatest good, it may not be for the greatest number. Not everyone counts when one is tallying up the greatest number. And only hospitals, insurance companies, and drug companies are allowed to define the greatest number. So how will the doctor know when the count is updated? Well, he has to seek out continuing medical education, usually designed by drug companies. He has to read the insurance contract carefully and abide by it. Violation of an insurance contract is grounds for license revocation in New York State. And the doctor also has to read and abide by hospital policies. So these are the ways in which the doctor will be aware when the count is being updated, when the greatest good for the greatest number, when the definition is shifting. So how does the doctor apply this with each individual patient? And the answer is the doctor never, ever treats any one patient. Isn't that wonderful? The doctor always bases his treatment on a group of patients that he has never met in a study that cannot be reproduced, financed by a pharmaceutical company or other interests. So let me say this again. How is the doctor to apply this with each individual patient? The doctor never treats any one patient. Treatment is always based on a group of patients the doctor has never met in a study that cannot be reproduced. And this is really important. So if someone says, ask your doctor, or get individualized therapy from your doctor, it's not possible to get individualized therapy from your doctor because your doctor's training hasn't been based on individuals. So the greatest good for the greatest number allows for a calculation that excludes harm. Only good is being counted. In the example we talked about with transplants, for example, the death of one person to sacrifice the organs results in $11.2 million in economic activity to the medical industry and benefit to at least 10 recipients and joy to their families. Clearly, the benefit to the many recipients and members of the medical community outweigh the benefit to any one patient in keeping his life and his organs. This is a stark example of how a greatest good for the greatest number type calculation leads very clearly to harm to the patient that is in the front of the doctor. And if you recall, during our transplant episode, there was a doctor actually calling for the right to end a person's life when death is imminent but not inevitable. In other words, to kill people who might not have died had the doctor not intervened, but to kill them and take their organs because it would result in the greatest good for the greatest number. You're listening to Healing with Dr. Daniels on the Rainbow Soul channel at BlakeRadio.com. Please visit Amazon.com and get your copy of Murder by Medicine is No Accident. Be the first in your circle to get Dr. Daniels' new Kindle book, Murder by Medicine is No Accident. It even gave my editor goosebumps. A great read. As always, I welcome your calls and questions. Please call in at 914-338-0695. Now, ask your doctor, how can you protect yourself from this, right? First of all, ask your doctor. Ask him, hey, doc, do you believe in the greatest good for the greatest number? If he says yes, you can end the visit right there while you still have your life, or you can tell him you just want what is best for you, not what is best for society, the insurance company, the hospital, his pocketbook, gifts from the last drug rep, or a new study, or anyone not present in the exam room. And if the doctor balks, ask if you agree to pay cash, or if you agree not to use your insurance, would that help? You know, I have had to tell patients that if they want to use their insurance, there are certain things I cannot tell them. If they want the truth and they want me to tell them of all the options I'm aware of, they have to pay for the visit themselves. This is what led me to stop taking insurance. I get tired of having this conversation with people. As you would appreciate it. Also, tell your doctor that you would appreciate it if he would tell you when your greatest benefit is not the same as his greatest benefit. This is important. Don't use words like conflict of interest, because the doctor's like, oh, I have no conflict. I'm doing this very easily and comfortably. I have no inner conflict at all. I feel just totally cool with what I'm doing. So if you use words like conflict of interest, that throws the doctor off track. Let him know that you want him to tell you when your greatest benefit is not the same as his greatest benefit. He'll understand that. That's very clear. Now, this is enough to get your doctor to wake up and refocus on you and your benefit. Now, a lot of doctors are going to tell you at that point to leave the office. They're going to tell you, get out of here. Do not be insulted. Realize that what you got was a dangerous doctor refusing to murder you, refusing to abuse you. And I would say when Dr. Ash should leave his office, always, always, always leave. Always. Because what he's saying is he's you're not on his docket to murder. Now, let's take a look at where the greatest good for the greatest number can lead. And this happened not very long ago, in August 2nd. Okay, this happened August 2nd in 2013. It's like a week ago. Just a few weeks shy of his 96th birthday, in need of a walker to move about, cops came through the door of this man's retirement home with a taser and a shotgun, and he was tased and he was shot with a shotgun. For what offense? I'll let you know after the break. You're listening to Healing with Dr. Daniels on the Rainbow Soul channel at BlakeRadio.com. Please visit Amazon.com and be the first in your group to review Murder by Medicine is No Accident. be the first in your circle to get Dr. Dana's new Kindle book, Murder by Medicine is No Accident. You no longer have to fumble and stutter as you try to tell your loved ones of the medical dangers. It even gave my editor goosebumps. So what happened? The old man I just mentioned was described by a family member, as I said, wobbly on his feet. He had refused medical attention. He refused to take his pills at the nursing home. The paramedics were called, and the paramedics called the Park Forest Police. And this 96-year-old patient, no, let's give him more dignity than that. He's not a patient. He's a human. Was murdered for refusing medications. Murdered by police for refusing to participate in the greatest good for the greatest number. Now, this sounds really shocking, doesn't it? This is a story in the Chicago Tribune on August 2nd, 2013. So how could this have been avoided? And this is what you need to understand and get a grip on. First, never trust your health to an institution. If you have to, then when you want to refuse, you have to say, I am praying on it. Okay, everyone, say this with me. I am praying on it. That's it. That means no. Okay? So you can't tell a doctor no. You just say, I am praying on it. And when you do that, watch how they stand back and pause. Now wait. And they'll say, are you through praying? And then you'll say, I'm still praying on it. Then they have to leave. Every health professional, whether it's a nurse, a medic, a doctor, a hospital administrator, they all know the sign of the cross, that's it. It's like Dracula. Got to back off. So the only basis for refusing is the practice of religion. Which religion you're practicing can be sorted out later with the assistance of your lawyer. But at least you will still be alive. So, a protocol, as I mentioned, is a very dangerous thing and seldom helps the individual on the receiving end. A protocol is a series of actions a doctor must follow, regardless of how poorly the patient is doing. It is devised through research and represents the greatest benefit to the fewest number of patients, as demonstrated by research. Now, I get that. The greatest benefit to the fewest number of patients. In other words, it is acceptable that the probability of benefit to the person in front of you is minuscule because the protocol is designed to be sure that all are offered a therapy so that a small number who could benefit are offered the therapy in question. This parallels the reasoning that if a teacher can change the life of one child in a 20-year time period of teaching, her career will be a success. Doctors are trained to aspire to this dismal batting average in terms of patient benefit and a 100% success rate when it comes to billing collectibles. To achieve this, the doctor convinces the patient that he is certain to suffer without the therapy, and he may be the very one who will benefit, the lucky one in 100,000, who will be better off with the test or therapy in question. The doctor is trained to aim for the greatest good for the greatest number with no regard for harm. Harm is redefined. Harm becomes side effects. Harm becomes complications. Harm becomes risk that is outweighed by benefit. Benefit not necessarily to the person sitting in front of the doctor. You are listening to Healing with Dr. Daniels on the Rainbow Soul channel at blakeradio.com. Please visit amazon.com and get your copy of Murder by Medicine is No Accident. Be the first in your circle to get Dr. Daniels' new Kindle book, Murder by Medicine is No Accident. You no longer have to fumble and stutter as you try to tell your loved ones of the medical dangers. It even gave my editor goosebumps. A great read, true story. As always, I welcome your calls and questions. Please call in at 914-338-0695. Now, this mentality drives the doctor to recommend gruesome procedures like bone marrow biopsy in the hopes that he will be the lucky doctor who can report a success. He is offering the patient something that, if applied to the whole population, will unearth the proverbial needle in a haystack. This is of no benefit to the patient, even if he does turn out to be the needle instead of offering benefit, the doctor is trained to offer the opportunity to benefit. This distracts the doctor from the reality that he's harming 999 people to detect one diagnosis. Further, the therapy available for the one that is detected is not a proven benefit. To top it all off, there's a conflict of interest. The doctor is gambling with the patient's money and the patient's health. He is intrinsically biased as he gets to keep a portion of the patient's money. He's gambling on the patient's behalf. This is like allowing the house to place bets for the gamblers until the gambler is broke. The house wins. In medical school, no consideration is given to the possibility that the therapy will benefit one in 1,250 who take it, and that benefit may not appear in the brief 40-year span of the doctor's career. The doctor is instead trained to focus on benefit to a mythical individual that's not sitting in front of him. The greatest good for the greatest number is a dangerous state of mind that is triggered in the doctor when people have certain titles. Yes, we're going to talk about your titles. So how should your doctor address you? Miss Jones? Mrs. Jones? Mr. Jackson? Joe? Sally? This may seem trivial, but it's critical. Doctors are trained to uphold what is good for society and constantly balance what is good for you with what is good for society, and to do what is good for society, the greatest good for the greatest number, remember? Yes. This type of goal setting allows the doctor to do something that is very bad for you on the basis that if he keeps doing it, one day someone will walk into his office and be the one who will benefit. The action he recommends will be good for the greatest number, the system. So, who's not counted? People who do not benefit society, like you mentioned. For example, if you have insurance, the doctor is trained that he should be a good husband of resources and not expend resources at your request, as that would take resources away from another person in your insurance plan, or worse, the government, and leave taxpayers, the doctor and people like him, worse off. The presumption is that the insurance company knows how much money is available and is in a position to wisely parcel out these resources via its policies. The insurance companies have information that the doctor doesn't have, so it's okay for the insurance companies to make decisions about your care. Patient loses, insurance company wins. Insurance company rules must always be followed. This is the programming. So how does the doctor address the insurance company representative? Or better yet, the insurance company executive? How is the insurance company person introduced at meetings? Mr. This is the title that stops the doctor's authority cold. Mr. means rulemaker, boss man, person to be obeyed. If you are male, be sure your doctor refers to you by the title Mr., followed by your last name. This puts you in executive class in his mind. When the protocol calls for deadly therapy, he will stutter before he recommends it to you, and may even skip that step. So if you allow a doctor to call you by your first name, that spells patient, subordinate, a person whose death can be easily covered. So if you're a guy, don't do it. Have your doctor call you Mr. and fill in the blank with your last name. Insist on it. It could save your life. So what about women? Well, this is curious. Women are a different story, complicated story too. Women are either married, in which case they are an important part of society, and have paid their dues by subordinating themselves to a man. Almost any man will do. They are the property of that man. This means if something goes wrong, there is someone to answer to. It also means that any child this lady is carrying, this married woman, will be a benefit to society. So if you're married, insist that your doctor call you Mrs. This flips a switch in his mind that you have backup. If he harms you, your husband may show up. Never, in a visit, allow the doctor to make a joke about or belittle your husband. He's sizing up the threat that your husband may become in the event you ever suffer a complication from the standard of care. You want the doctor to know that if you do not come home in perfect condition, or if anything happens, your husband will not be happy, and everyone wants to please your husband. Now, what if you're a single woman? Well, if you're a single woman, that's unfortunate. Single women in medicine are portrayed as selfish if they do not have children, or loose, promiscuous, and raising a crime wave if they do have children, and lacking proper supervision because, of course, they do not have a husband. If you're living with a partner That's none of the doctor's business. If you do reveal this bit of information, you become a wanton woman. In medical school, we actually have discussed if it's proper to admit the child of divorced parents to medical school. Can you imagine? Again and again, we're reminded that as physicians, we are taught that we are bound by the Judeo-Christian ethic. In other words, if the Bible or Torah are against it, then why we are too. Now you can imagine, as a person not raised in either the Judeo or the Christian ethic, I wanted to know. For God's sake, give me the doctor, let me read it so I can understand what I'm supposed to be following here. But they said, excuse me, Jennifer, we're not going to produce a Torah or a Bible for you to read. I said, well, I want to know which part of the Judeo-Christian ethic I'm supposed to be following here. I never did get a square answer on that one. Except to say that that's what guided our society's values. So this is easily translated into who deserves to live and who deserves to die. We even have triage scenarios in medical school where information other than the patient's medical condition is taken into account, things like marital status or occupation. So just by how you allow your doctor to address you, you've indicated to him your relative social status. Now, if you're another doctor, too bad. You get the standard of care in spades. This is why doctors' wives have the worst and most traumatic deliveries. Everything must be done. Most of those things are painful, harmful, and, of course, unnecessary. The doctor's wife does not refuse because she believes this must all be okay. After all, this is how her husband makes his living. So if you're a woman, it's best to be the wife of anything except a lawyer or a doctor. Lawyers get the standard of care every time if the doctor knows he cannot be sued if he provides the standard of care. And this is what he will be judged by in the event he has to appear in court. So the doctor does not realize that adhering to the standard of care increases the chances he will end up in court. So the greatest good for the greatest number means that the benefit to people not in the exam room outweighs the benefit to the patient in the exam room. That means you. So the greatest good for the greatest number validates the practice of allowing individuals who are not in the exam room to determine the decisions made. Whether these individuals be government agencies, insurance companies, drug companies, this concept guarantees a patient's medical condition, patient's personal preferences, take a back seat to the financial and political interests of the day. While medical information may be confidential, the patient is the only person left in the dark. So what to do? Well, stay out of the doctor's office. Next, since the doctor is an agent of the government, drug companies, and insurance companies, the only reason to see the doctor is to access the resources of one of these institutions through the power invested in the doctor. That would be disability insurance benefits, a back-to-work note, sick leave, social security benefits, etc. Headache is not a reasonable issue to take to the doctor. He's not authorized to resolve a headache to your benefit. Always tell the doctor that you will pray on it. Never comply with therapy or commit to any action. Never openly defy the doctor. Always indicate that you will pray on it. Every doctor knows that he must cease and desist when a patient says he will pray on it. Doctors don't understand that they are an agent of the state and therefore must not prevent any patient from the faithful practice of their religion. But now that you know that, it's your ultimate defense. Finally, if you have the guts to do it, drop your health insurance. If you do not have health insurance, the doctor cannot compel therapy. This is a nuance. There are only two cases where care may be withheld: when it is not an emergency and the patient is unable or unwilling to pay, or when the patient refuses based on religious practice. So if you refuse to carry health insurance, the doctor will automatically be inclined to stop and check your wallet or check your consent before proceeding. We have one question here, so let's take this question.
Hi, Heidi.
How are you?
Good, thank you. Let's see. My question is, how did that religious practice get started about saying that I'm going to pray on it?
Oh, give me the second part, and then I'll answer both.
Yeah, the second part is, do you think that will ever be changed?
Okay, good question. All right, I'll answer those off the air. First question, how was it started? I believe it was a Seventh-day Adventist who didn't believe in blood transfusions. And what happened was They want to refuse a transfusion. The doctor wanted to give the transfusion. And in order to compel the patient to take the transfusion, the medical, the hospital doctor went to the courts, which is the government, and says, hey, we want you to make this patient do it. And what finally happened after years and years and years of litigation was it was established that the government cannot intervene and interfere with a person's practice of medicine. So you can't call the police to get somebody to take a medicine if they're preying on it. In other words, if they're committing a religious act. So that was one. The next thing was the Karen Ann Quinlan case, where the hospital and doctors went to court to compel the parents to continue heroic therapy for a patient who was on a ventilator and comatose for an extended period of time. So what happened was ultimately the judge decided in favor of the parents, that the parents had the right. The parents said they based this on their belief. It's their belief. This is key. You cannot, you do not have the right to refuse medical therapy because you've weighed the facts and you think that it's a bad idea. Because as a patient, you are before the courts an incompetent, not an expert, not competent to decide. So you can only, your only ground to stand on outside of court and in court is your belief. So you can only say, I believe. So I'm praying and I believe. So those two landmark cases establish a patient's right to their belief, a patient's right. And it's your belief in your religion and your belief that this medical recommendation is not within your acceptable practice of your belief. And that's important. You can't say, I believe vaccines are harmful. No. I believe vaccines interfere with my practice of my beliefs. And that sounds circuitous, but it's really very precise. And people say, I believe vaccines are bad, I believe vaccines are harmful, the government can come right in there, seize their children, you know, it's a mess. But if you're preying on it, then that puts everything on perpetual hold. And you always let people know that you are still praying. You know, the prayer never ends. So, and do I think that's going to end in the future? Unfortunately, yes. There are attempts to make inroads into this through administrative fiat. What's administrative fiat? Administrative fiat is saying you can't have this government benefit unless you submit to that medical intervention. And so people need to see this for what it is and say that, you know, and call the government on it and say, whoa, I'm exercising my belief, I'm exercising my religion, I'm praying on it. And so that's what has to happen. And so I think people need to really exercise and strengthen this prayer muscle in this I believe practice, because right now it's really the only opening for objection that exists. Now we come to the end of our hour. Next week is a very exciting episode. I'm going to tell you how to deliver your own baby at home, whether you want to use living room floor or the bedroom, whatever. Actually, because a listener requested that, so obviously not medical advice. But I'll share with you my experiences with home deliveries, and hopefully it'll inspire you to save basically $18,000 per delivery. And it's enough to make a 6-child family affordable again. So that'll be next week, same place, same time. And, you know, how to deliver your own baby at home. And please email me, support@vitalitycapsules.com, and let me know what topics you would like to hear in the future.